In 2020, you had nothing, right? So people were hoping, isn't there something maybe on the pharmacy shelves that we already have that we could use to help ameliorate this disease? And so hydroxychloroquine, an anti-malarial drug, popped up, or ivermectin, which is sort of an anti-parasitic drug, popped up. How about those?
And, I used to buy a lot of ivermectin, but that's because I used to have horses.
That was the meme, right? Ask your large animal veterinarian whether ivermectin
is right for you.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, and welcome back to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I am your host, as always, Rick Wilson, back from the new year. It is a new year indeed. We are already seeing the early tidal wave of insanity cresting toward us from the Trump administration. And my guest today is going to enlighten us on a segment of the coming insanity that makes me completely uncomfortable in every way. And that is this anti-scientific RFK Jr. anti-vax cult that Trump and a lot of his followers seem to have bought into. Our guest today is Paul Offit. Paul is a medical doctor, an immunologist, a guy who understands pediatric immunology and medicine better than almost any human being you're going to meet. He's the author of Tell Me When It's Over, An Insider's Guide to Deciphering COVID Myths and Navigating Our Post-Pandemic World, and the author of the excellent Beyond the Noise Substack, where he talks about the things that matter in these discussions about healthcare, about vaccines, about science, about the fact that we live in a world where pandemics are real, and we have to face them with seriousness, not with conspiracies. So with that, Paul, I want to welcome you to the show. Thank you so much for coming on today. Really appreciate it. And I read your article that you posted on Beyond the Noise called Questions for RFK's Senate Confirmation. And I was delighted because I've been a critic of RFK's anti-vax insanity, which on social media, second only to being anti-Trump, being anti-vax will bring out the crazy. Talk to us about your knowledge of RFK Jr. and why he's so spectacularly unqualified to lead the Department of Health and Human Services.
Actually, he called me about 20 years ago and said that there were parents who had come to his office who were concerned about this ethyl mercury-containing preservative that was in vaccines called thimerosal. Sure. By the time he called me, it was largely out of vaccines. And he wanted to know whether or not there were scientific studies that could make these parents feel better that they hadn't hurt their children. So this was easy to address because Western Europe had taken thimerosal out of vaccines in the early 90s. There were Canadian provinces that used these vaccines that contained thimerosal right next to those provinces that used the same vaccines that didn't contain thimerosal. We took it out by about 2000, 2001. So it was easy to address this, and I had a really good conversation. It was great. I mean, I'm going home to my wife that night and saying, I really think I reassured him. We're good. And then in July 2005, he published an article in Rolling Stone called Deadly Immunity, where he just had been gaslighting me. He just laid me out as a bad guy. I was just deeply in the pocket of industry, that there was 187 times more mercury in vaccines than was allowable. And I'm the inventor of a vaccine called the rotavirus vaccine, right? Rotatec. My vaccine was, quote unquote, laced with thimerosal, although our vaccine contained no thimerosal because it's a live attenuated viral vaccine. So I called the editor and I said, this is all wrong. There are like fact after fact after fact is wrong in this article. And they eventually withdrew it, and it had been on Salon.com and they withdrew it. But that was really his entrance into the anti-vaccine world. And I'm glad to say that I was a part of that. You're welcome.
So I want to remind folks again, you have invented a vaccine against the rotavirus, which while not as dramatic as COVID, is still something that caused an enormous amount of distress among infants and children, and a lot of deaths among infants and children prior to its introduction.
Right. No. The rotavirus as a single agent was the biggest killer of infants and young children in the world. About 500,000 babies would die every year, as many as 2,000 a day. And our vaccine, which was recommended and and licensed in February of 2006, is estimated to save about 165,000 lives a year. So, yeah, I mean, I was fortunate enough to be part of it, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that created this, and it's probably the accomplishment of which I'm most proud. But according to RFK Jr., this makes me an evil man.
You know, Paul, one of the things that I'm 61 years old. I remember as a kid, there was still, some people were still afraid that polio was out there. But the polio vaccine was one of our greatest success stories in this country. It prevents about 20,000 people a year from being paralyzed and a couple thousand from dying. Why is it that RFK is saying there are no safe and effective viruses? We've been doing the polio vaccine now for many, many decades, seven decades now, something to that effect. What is it about, how do you get locked into this kind of conspiracy theory where the net good that vaccines have done is completely ignored and edge case conspiracies become the replacement for scientific rigor?
Right. I don't think people realize just how deeply flawed RFK Jr. is in his reasoning. If you read his book, I don't recommend it, called The Real Anthony Fauci, you will find between pages 285 and 291 that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. does not believe in the germ theory. He does not believe that specific germs cause specific diseases and that the prevention or treatment of those germs, like viruses or bacteria, is of value. He believes rather that if you just have a robust immune system, avoid toxins, including environmental toxins, that you don't need vaccines. That's why it is that he says things like the hepatitis B vaccine doesn't work. Or he'll say that to Lex Fridman on his podcast, which has 3 million listeners, that no vaccine is a benefit. And when Lex Fridman followed up and said, well, how about the polio vaccine, which, you know, Kennedy was born in 1954. That was a year before the polio vaccine came out. He certainly was alive at a time in the 1950s when polio was the most feared disease in this country. And you saw us go from, as you said, tens of thousands of cases of paralysis a year, about 1,800 to 2,000 deaths a year, to basically eliminating that virus from the United States by 1979. Isn't it obvious that that vaccine was of value? And he said, no, that vaccine killed many, 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 many more people than it ever saved. So this is where he's coming from. He doesn't think HIV is the cause of AIDS. I mean, it's really hard to watch all this. It's like an SNL parody of somebody who would be head of Health and Human Services.
I mean, sticking with polio for one more minute, because it just strikes me as like one of the brightest lines in this equation. Polio still exists in the world, in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan. What would happen if tomorrow children stop getting the polio vaccine in this country?
Well, you've already seen an example of what could happen, because in 2022, a 27-year-old man who had never left this country in Rockland County, New York, got polio. And he got polio from a strain that is in this country. It's the so-called vaccine-derived type 2 polio virus, which was a consequence of Albert Sabin's oral polio vaccine. I mean, that vaccine was great and that it helped to eliminate polio from this country and other countries in the world. But it had a critical flaw, which is that it could revert to essentially paralytic type or neurovirulent type. It was rare. It occurred in maybe 1.2.4 million children, but it was real. And those strains are still around. That outbreak in Gaza was caused by that strain. That was the strain that paralyzed this man in Rockland County. And it paralyzed him because in his community, the immunization rates were only 30%. Drop immunization rates far enough, and you will once again see polio come back to this country. And I was born before Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I was born in 1951. So, and when I had an operation on my foot when I was five, and I was in a polio ward for about 6 weeks. And I remember polio. I remember iron lungs. I remember the so-called Sister Kenny hot pack treatments, where children with withered arms and legs would have these excruciatingly hot packs put on their arms and legs. And this was when there was one visiting hour a week. It was really this Dickensian experience. We don't want to relive that virus.
Does it strike you at this point that from what you've heard so far, that the Senate is taking the risks of Robert F. Kennedy's potential confirmation seriously? I feel like they are not. That's sort of my sense right now, is that there's still this moment where they're giving Trump or they're giving Kennedy a a pass so far on this. I mean, do you think legislative folks are getting it that he presents an enormous and immediate risk to the health of American families and children?
I don't know. I mean, I know that some of them have reached out to us, meaning people in the medical world, to get more information on RFK Jr. So I know some of them are concerned, but you even hear tell that certain Democrats, you know, like Bernie Sanders or Kristen Gillibrand or Cory Booker or John Fetterman have considered voting for him. Because one thing he says in his sort of make America healthy again notion is that we have more chronic diseases in this country, like obesity and type 2 diabetes. True. And that we're not getting bang for our healthcare buck. We spend a lot of money on healthcare, although we have a $1.85 trillion HHS budget, yet we're not ranked high at all among other developed world countries in terms of infant mortality, in terms of longevity. So what's wrong? And I think, sure, that's great. But what's he planning on doing about that? Because a lot of that is lifestyle choices. I mean, what is he going to do instead of just kind of vaguely waving his hand and saying, these are bad things and we need to do something? That is appealing to some, but he doesn't lay out exactly what his agenda is. He said things like, I think the National Institutes of Health have focused too much on infectious diseases. Let's give infectious diseases a break for a while and focus on chronic diseases. Give infectious diseases a break for a while, because I'm going to tell you, you're not going to be giving us a break for a while. We've had three pandemic coronaviruses in the last 20 years. This isn't the end of it.
I mean, even beyond RFK, there has been this emergence, especially, and I, you know, for my progressive listeners and my liberal listeners, I will say I used to, when I was a Republican, find it very concerning. There was a sort of West Coast Hollywood feel of like vaccines could be substituted for crystals or sunshine or whatever. And I thought that was a really risky proposition. But I think on the right now, it has become so weaponized and driven by policy now of saying things like, we're not going to require childhood vaccinations for schools. We're not going to require people to, you know, to show proof that their children have had the DPT and polio and other vaccines. My question remains, it's like, how long does it take for the impact of this to start hitting people? I feel like we could be in a couple of years in a state where childhood mortality spikes because of a political decision by a lot of people not to have their kids vaccinated.
I think we're getting there. I mean, if you look, last year we had 5,000 cases of whooping cough. This year, 32,000. Last year we had four measles outbreaks involving about 50 children. This year we've had 16 measles outbreaks involving over 280 children. Get to 1,000 or 2,000 children with measles, and you'll start to see children dying again because it has a mortality rate of 0.1%, meaning one per thousand. Right. I mean, I'm out of the 50s. I had measles. At that time, measles would cause 3 to 4 million cases, 48,000 hospitalizations, about 500 deaths. And you're starting to now see this, the dam break. And the virus that's going to come back first, because it is far and away the most contagious of the vaccine preventable diseases, is measles. And measles can make you sick and it can make you die. And I think people don't realize that when measles was occurring back in the 50s, every year, 1,000 children would suffer encephalitis, which is swelling of the brain, a quarter of whom would have permanent brain damage. This is not a virus to fool around with. And I feel like not only have we largely eliminated measles, we've eliminated the memory of measles. People don't remember how sick that virus can make you.
It's the whole, like the combination virus, the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. The idea, I mean, Joseph Latipo, who is the Secretary of Health and Human Services for the state of Florida, is opposed to having it be a requirement for children in school. It's mind-boggling to me. And you know, I get that people think chickenpox is harmless. And for a lot of kids, chickenpox was just a sort of a thing they went through. But that virus has also prevented a lot more misery and scarring and everything else. I will say this. My mom forgot which of her children had chickenpox. So when I was 33 years old, I got chickenpox and it damn near killed me. It was still before the vaccine, but it damn near killed me. I was not a fun experience, but I mean, I guess that's part of the tragedy of this, of the RFK space and this anti-vax space, is that once again, these people just, they've closed their eyes to the benefit to society and to themselves and to their families, of the, some of the most thoroughly tested medical innovations in history. Talk to us a little bit about just how deeply tested all these things are. These aren't just slapped out there to make money for the for pharma. They are enormously rigorously examined and tested. Because I think that's something that there's a sort of like dark belief that like there's a conspiracy to just this is all about cash, and it's just not.
Well, I think COVID's probably the best example because it's the one that's most recent and most in people's minds. And I'm on the FDA's Vaccine Advisory Committee. So in December of 2020, we considered those two messenger RNA vaccines by Pfizer and Moderna. And everybody assumed, well, we just instantly quickly made them, and that was that, you know, because we isolated the virus in January of 2020. We and sequenced it, and then we could actually make those vaccines, which we then had done two large clinical trials, 40,000 for Pfizer, 30,000 for Moderna. That's the size of any typical adult or pediatric vaccine trial. Prospective placebo-controlled trials at the time when hundreds or thousands of people were dying a day, we still did those prospective placebo-controlled trials. And everybody thinks, well, the mRNA was just just instantly invented. But if you look back, first of all, the National Institutes of Health had been supporting people like Drew Weissman and Katie Carrico, who are this year's Nobel Prize winners in medicine, ever since 1997, to work on messenger RNA. I mean, when SARS-1 came about in 2002, 2003, in-house at NIH, people like Barney Graham and Kizzy Corbett were working on messenger RNA vaccines. You know, so we had really a couple decades worth of work before we ever released that vaccine. And people don't see the area below the surface. They're just seeing that tip of the iceberg. And even then, once the vaccine was released, there were systems in place like the vaccine safety data link that could pick up very, very rare side effects like myocarditis, inflammation of the heart muscle, occurring in 1 in 50,000 people. With Johnson & Johnson's vaccine, which came out in February of 2021, clotting, which occurred in 1 in 250,000 people. Those are rare events and were quickly picked up because we have systems in place to make sure these vaccines are safe. And I think people... they just don't appreciate it. I think the problem with this, see, I would have imagined in a better world, which world we don't apparently clearly are not, but, you know, that people would have seen vaccines for what they were, which was a lifesaver. Those vaccines were estimated to save 3 million American lives. But what ended up happening was, I think in 2020, we didn't have anything. Right? We didn't have antivirals till October. We didn't have monoclonals till November. We didn't have vaccines till December. We had nothing. So all we could do was limit human to human contact. So we shuttered schools. Closed businesses, we restricted travel, we isolated, we masked, we quarantined, and people saw that as massive government overreach. And then the following year in 2021, although you were 12 times more likely to be hospitalized and die if you weren't vaccinated than if you were, we mandated vaccines. And people, you know, so you couldn't get into your favorite bar or restaurant or sporting event or place of worship unless you had shown that you were vaccinated, which people also saw as massive government overreach. And so there was an enormous backlash. We leaned into this libertarian left hook, and people have pushed back legislatively ever since to try and decrease masks and decrease school mandates. And I think we're seeing an erosion now. We have more people who are choosing not to vaccinate their kindergartners than ever before. That paper was just published by the CDC. That's why we're seeing these increases in diseases like pertussis and measles. It's hard to watch.
Yeah, and I do think, I mean, the mask mandates and the shutdowns and the lockdowns had a bigger political impact than anybody in the medical or scientific community was contemplating, and they were right not to be contemplating it. They were trying to get mitigation to whatever degree they could of what was a massive crisis, and those kinds of questions, I mean, that you proposed to ask RFK, a lot of that is a lot of his crazy statements in Real Anthony Fauci. Just were absolutely lies. Like he talked about in that book that hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, which are now articles of faith on the far right, could keep people from being hospitalized. None of that was real, though. This political reaction has led to an alternate reality. As a medical professional, how do you handle that?
You do the best you can. See, I understand it in part. Like in 2020, you had nothing, right? So people were hoping, isn't there something maybe on the pharmacy shelves that we already have that we could use to help ameliorate this disease? And so hydroxychloroquine, an anti-malarial drug, popped up. Or ivermectin, which is sort of an anti-parasitic drug, popped up. How about those?
And, I used to buy a lot of ivermectin, but that's because I used to have horses.
That was the meme, right? Ask your large animal veterinarian whether ivermectin
is right for you. I'm sorry, go ahead.
So it's fair. It's fair to ask the question, but see, it's an answerable question. It's a scientific question that can be answered in a scientific venue. So you had large scientific studies where you either got hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or you didn't, and then to see whether it kept you out of the hospital. And it didn't. It didn't work. And see, what bothers me at that point is that people then just refused to believe it. They just said, well, as RFK Jr. said in his book, that the Lancet was lying, that the New England Journal of Medicine was lying. Medical journals were lying, that the pharmaceutical company was, you know, didn't want you to use this because they wanted you to use something more expensive. Just this kind of conspiracy, this free-floating conspiracy that sells. It's really hard to watch this kind of, I think science is losing its place as a source of truth, and only danger can follow something like that.
Right. The idea that we don't have an adherence to or a belief in the primacy of science in these questions, and that it's how people feel and what conspiracies are driving them, to my mind is deeply disturbing. But every hearing for an appointment ends up with about 70 or 80 questions being asked of the person. I know this because I used to do appointments when I worked in the government. And they come from all the different members of the committees. Each one of them gets a couple. Some of them will dive in deeper. Some of them will ask only one. What would be, to your mind, the most illustrative of the questions that you've talked about RFK that you would want the public to hear asked in that committee hearing?
I think that he is a believer that vaccines are hurting children, that vaccines have caused chronic diseases, and although they have largely eliminated infectious diseases, that it was too high of a price to pay. And so I would ask him this question. You have said that you think no vaccine is safe and effective. You have said that when you come upon someone on a running trail who is carrying a baby, that you go up to them and you say, don't vaccinate this child. And you have said you think you've just saved that child. If you hold those beliefs, are you going to continue to allow the CDC to recommend vaccines? Or are you going to continue to allow children to have this, to be part of this recommended schedule? Or are you going to in any way try and change that schedule? Try and make sure the children get fewer vaccines than they're getting now. Are you going to do that? Now, what I don't trust his answer, because he'll stand up and he'll say, I'm not getting a vaccine, even though when you say that vaccines are unsafe and you're trying to scare people away from them, you're anti-vaccine. So he's not a truth teller, but that would be the question I would ask him. Are you going to do anything to change the vaccine programs that are currently in place that have saved our lives? We live 30 years longer than we did 100 years ago because of vaccines. When he can say, a man who was born a year before there was a polio vaccine, that he thinks the polio vaccine killed more people than it saved, he's just dealing in a different reality.
You have a cluster of people around Kennedy who apparently, and I don't know all their names, but I've been doing a little bit of reading about this. There are some people that have influenced his thinking on this stuff who are kooks, who are lunatics. Do you think he should be asked about any of those people? And if so, whom? Because apparently there are some of the folks around him who are sort of the drivers of a lot of the national anti-vax movement.
Right, which, by the way, has never been better funded. I mean, groups like the Informed Consent Action Network, which is an anti-vaccine group, has never been better funded. Right. Groups like his group, Children's Health Defense, never had more money in its coffers than it has now. Sure, I would ask him about people like Del Bigtree, who's head of the Informed Consent Action Network, or Holland. I mean, these are people who influence him, and ask that question. You know, are they in any way going to be part of your administration?
Right. And it looks like some of them may end up in that space because apparently Kennedy is one of the few members of the administration's incoming cabinet secretaries who's getting to pick his own people. They're not going through the same process that Trump has applied to his other appointees and nominees, which I think should scare the hell out of the people right now, because if they're worse than RFK Jr., they're really, 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 really terrifyingly bad.
Right. I feel like, you know, there's an old W.H. Auden quote, which is, you know, when all the mass and majesty of this world, when all that always weighed, carried weight and weighed the same, lay in the hands of the other of others. That's what I feel like we're at now. Everything that used to matter, like good scientific studies, you know, proofs of whether something is associated with something else, doesn't matter. I mean, the notion that measles, mumps, rubella vaccine caused autism, which was raised in 1998 by a now discredited UK researcher named Andrew Wakefield, it's fine to ask that question. My child's fine. They got this vaccine. Now they're not fine. Could the vaccine have done it? That's an answerable question. It's been answered now in more than a dozen studies in seven countries on three continents involving thousands of children doing those studies the right way. It's done, asked and answered, yet still, you know, he sounds that bell. And the harm that he causes is there was just a paper in Journal of the American Medical Association showing that children who have autism or autism spectrum disorder are less likely to be vaccinated, as are their healthy siblings. And so that's what continuing to sound that bell does. It puts children at risk, at unnecessary risk.
Let me ask you this question. It's a sort of prospective hypothetical approach. Let's say it's August of this year, and suddenly sweeping out of China emerges a new pandemic. And there are things out there right now, the HPNV or whatever it is, that worries some people. But let's just say there's another pandemic in the same transmissibility and impact as COVID. And RFK is the Secretary of Health and Human Services. What do you think the outcome would look like for this country if he were in charge during a serious pandemic?
Well, look at how he thought about the last one. He says, quote, "The COVID vaccine is the most dangerous vaccine ever made." Actually, it's remarkably safe compared to even other vaccines like the smallpox vaccine. Either a polio vaccine. Right. It's a very safe vaccine. It's not absolutely safe, but nothing in medicine is absolutely safe. Anything that has a positive effect will always have some negative effect. The only question is how rare and how serious. This was a remarkably safe and effective vaccine that saved our lives and saved our lives quickly. Yet he calls it the most dangerous vaccine ever made. You know, you have SARS-1 in 2002, you had MERS in 2002. You have SARS-CoV-2, you know, COVID in 2019, because we live in close association with bats. These are all animal killer events that have occurred in what is a large segment of the mammalian population, which is bats. I mean, if you look in rural China, for example, about 1 in 40 people will have antibodies against bat coronaviruses. So these spillover events probably happen all the time. It's just they have to happen in the right way, in the right place, as they did it to wholesale seafood market in late 2019. So there'll be another coronavirus pandemic. And what is he going to do about when he just said the last vaccine was the most dangerous vaccine ever made? Is he just going to advise that we take megavitamins, that we just try and exercise and diet? I mean, is that the goal, to avoid red dyes and Fruit Loops? Is that the goal?
I mean, that to me is that should chill people, I think, a lot about RFK Jr. The idea that if you think that vaccines are some sort of weird corporate lie, if you think that Corona or other pandemics are created in a lab to sell vaccines for big pharma, it's difficult for me to understand like how you can take that kind of person seriously, and yet Trump clearly did. Do you have any insight on was it Trump just realizing there's a percentage of people out there that respond to RFK Jr., or was it something deeper or darker than that, in your opinion?
I think RFK Jr. has disdain for the Department of Health and Human Services. And I think, frankly, the three people that have been mentioned, head either FDA or NIH or CDC, similarly have disdain for those agencies. Mm. I think that goal is to sort of just overturn the federal government at some level. I mean, to reveal the deep state, to look behind the curtain and find these evildoers that actually don't exist. And he also has a history of being anti-vaccine, Donald Trump. You remember during the run-up to the 2016 election, he said, you know, a child, perfectly healthy, 2.5-year-old, gets vaccines, has a high fever, and then develops autism. I think these kids are getting too much in the way of vaccines, meaning horse doses. And they need to get smaller doses because he would know that because he's, you know, real estate developer.
Noted virologist Donald Trump. Well, I think it's a deeply concerning and deeply troubling question right now, and I think it's one that we're going to see. I hope that we're going to see a lot of people in the Senate actually standing up to this, and actually trying to at least keep him in the space of accountability in some degree, because you know, your 100 questions for RFK Jr. I think are important and vital, but I'm hoping we're going to get enough evidence or in front of the members of the Senate to kill this nomination. We're certainly going to make it a front and center visibility issue. You know, because I want people in the Senate to understand they're voting to kill kids if they put this guy into the cabinet at HHS.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. The other thing, I was asked this the other day by a reporter, you know, but if it's not him, then it would be somebody else who is arguably equally just loyal and doesn't have competence to handle that position. But I honestly think nobody can be as bad as he is. He's been doing this for 20 years. He believes that he is a zealot. He really, really hates vaccines. And I think he would do something about it.
I think so, too. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show today, Paul. I really appreciate your wisdom and your insight on this. And we may talk again as the nomination heats up, because I think this is one of the things where the harm that could be done to American families and children in particular by Trump and RFK Jr. is almost incalculable. So thank you again for coming on the show, and we'll talk to you again very soon.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Thanks. You too.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joseph Werner-Cheney. Produced and edited by Whitney Hayes and Jeff Paylor.
And good luck.
Hey, everybody. If you'd like to get in touch, if you have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just general questions, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. That's podcast@lincolnproject.us.